Sarah Vaughan singing A Stairway to the Stars. And before that, we heard from Marion McPartland from a new album called Portrait of Marion McPartland. This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 26 minutes to 3 o'clock now. With me is Deirdre English, a feminist and radical journalist and author who is now a contributing editor to Mother Jones magazine. She's also the co-author with Barbara Ehrenreich of two books. One's called Witches, Midwives, and Nurses. And this is a book that, it's a small pamphlet-type book, actually, and it started off being published basically out of their homes, and it really became quite a popular book amongst women and has been very widely distributed because of that popularity. Their new book together is called For Her Own Good, 150 Years of the Expert's Advice to Women. That's published by Anchor Doubleday and has recently come out in paper. Deirdre, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Before we get to talking about some of the subjects that you've been writing about recently, which includes your analysis of the movie Apocalypse Now, I'd like to hear about your feelings as a radical journalist and as an investigative journalist and as the editor of other investigative journalists. What kind of effect would you ideally like to see investigative pieces have on both the people who are involved with the cause of the problems and the people who are the recipients of the ills caused by the problem?
Well, I think there's a very important role for investigative journalism in this country, and that it's really what our forefathers had in mind, the people who started this country and wrote the Constitution and said, really told us that part of freedom is having an investigative press, the kind of press that takes risks and challenges the way things are, challenges the system, and digs out facts. And one of the real problems of this decade has been that the few investigative journals have kind of died off in the post-Watergate period. And today, Mother Jones Magazine is one of the few that's still doing that basic muckraking.
You know, in some senses, I think investigative journalism has become chic. For instance, Gallery Magazine, which is a girly magazine, it's a magazine of nude pinups, has investigative pieces in it usually.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure that must be popular or something to have investigative pieces. Otherwise, I don't
really
know
why
they have it.
Yeah,
I mean, the quality of their investigative journalism would be a different subject.
Well, we really try to do something different in Mother Jones because, you know, actually, too much investigative reporting can be pretty depressing, hearing all the time about how corporations are ripping us off or selling us shoddy products and how the consumer is ignored and neglected in this country and, you know, prices go up, wages go down. I mean, we've heard all that before. And we at Mother Jones really try to present a much broader picture. We're always striving to tie the exposés that we do to deeper understanding of how the society functions and what we can do to change it. And in the coming year, we're going to be presenting a lot of strategy kind of articles that will talk about those issues. How can we as people come together and take actions to make the society work in a way that we won't have to expose quite as often?
Where are you usually in the pieces that you write as far as your point of view?
You mean what are my own politics or?
Well, what are your politics of allowing your politics to come out in the pieces that you write and your politics of allowing other people's, the people whose work you edit, come out in the pieces that they
mm-hmm.
write?
We were talking about the whole question of subjectivity and objectivity and in journalism, and I believe that objectivity is a very important thing and is a real goal that we need to strive for. I think there are facts, and there are different ways of measuring the truth of statements. And one of the things that the journalists of the 1960s did was to debunk the idea of objectivity a lot, saying that what was presented to us as objective wasn't always objective, and that is true. So, but when you do that, what I say is that what you don't want to do is throw out the whole concept of objectivity, but that you're challenging it with a superior objectivity, really.
What does that mean?
Well, what I'm saying is that maybe I should talk a little bit about the work that Barbara Ehrenreich and I did in our book, For Her Own Good. So much has been handed to us as women as scientific truth and has been given, told to us that this is the correct way to be a woman. This is the correct way to have sex. This is the correct way to raise your children. And it's based on scientific laboratory findings and comes out of the Yale School of Medicine or wherever. It's been told to you by doctors, and so it's objective. Well, that's not good enough. And we've found, as feminists, going back and scrutinizing much of that scientific research, that it was biased. It wasn't objective at all. It wasn't scientific. And so I think it's important for us as feminists to realize that when we criticize science on those grounds, we're really being more scientific than the scientists were themselves. If we find bias in their work, we're really finding something that made them fall short of the standards that they were supposedly upholding. So I think it's important for us to remember that, you know, in doing that kind of muckraking, we're not attacking objectivity, we're not attacking science. We're really representing a stricter kind of rationality.
So you're in a way trying to understand what the biases that originally formed the information were.
That's right. That's right. And we have found that the entire body of medical science in this country has been affected by the fact that it's been dreamed up and worked on and carried out by white upper-class males, for the most part. And so the same thing, I think, will increasingly prove to be true of many other areas of power and control in the society. I think eventually feminists will make those connections very clearly in all kinds of other areas, including in the area of military, the whole military machine.
What are some of the after effects of pieces that you've written in that pleased you? Effects of your writing that you thought were very good?
Well, in writing For Her Own Good with Barbara Ehrenreich, I think that Barbara and I would both say that we really wanted very much to increase women's self-confidence. And our hope was that women who read the book would feel stronger after reading it, would understand that when they questioned something that a doctor told them that challenged their own values or challenged their own feeling of well-being, that maybe they really had a pretty good reason for doing so, and there was some support out there in their thinking. And we've gotten responses from women who've told us that this was had just that kind of effect on them, and I think that's what means the most.
Mm-hmm. Deirdre, well, I'd like to talk about some of the things that you've been writing about recently in Weather Jones. You wrote a pretty large article on the movie Apocalypse Now, and gave it your analysis and your political interpretation of the movie. Can you summarize for us your reactions to the film?
Yeah, I was very disappointed in that film. And I had looked forward to it enormously. I thought of Francis Coppola as being one of our best directors in this country. And Michael Hare, who wrote the narration, was the author of Dispatches, and I think that was a very important book about the war in Vietnam, because he really was someone who had attempted to get the point of view of the what was called the grunt in Vietnam, the ordinary American soldier, and that's a point of view which has been neglected. So I looked forward to Apocalypse Now, and I thought it was going to be the 1960s movie of the war in Vietnam, the movie that would really show the American experience, and the movie that would do many of the things that which it did accomplish, show what the conditions were like, get the feel of the weather, the feel of the drugs in the American army, the anti-authoritarianism of the soldiers, and all that was there. So that, to that extent, Apocalypse Now broke through the old Pentagon lies about the war in Vietnam and brought us a little closer to the truth of what happened. But the reason that I was so very deeply disappointed was that it was completely, it was a complete failure in bringing us anything at all about the Vietnamese side of the war. And once again, the Vietnamese were kind of reduced to nothing, and then portrayed as savages in a way that just, it doesn't represent anything about what the Vietnamese were actually like during the war. So they're portrayed as kind of, it's a real 19th century notion of them, as kind of insane. And there's a story that's told, Marlon Brando tells it, in which he describes Vietnamese coming to a village and chopping off the arms of all of the children in the village for the reason that they had been inoculated by the Americans with an anti-polio vaccine. And then he reels in horror after he tells this story and says, and that's when he launches into his diatribe about the horror of the war. So the entire concept of horror has been placed on the Vietnamese. Brando is reacting to the horror of war as typified by this act of terrorism, very savage act that he describes. And that is, I think, a horrible historical violation. First of all, because the specific incident never took place. There's no evidence whatsoever that anything like that ever occurred. And we can talk a little bit more about that in the specifics. But secondly, because if you're going to talk about horror in the war in Vietnam, if you're going to talk about the very concept of man's brutality, you really have to talk about what the Americans did to the Vietnamese. You can't just talk about some atrocity that the Vietnamese committed.
In the film, there were a number of scenes of American troops led by a real nut, a real macho surfing jerk, who just would land and bloodily kill people. And the Vietnamese at that point were shown as being helpless victims and not as torturers or oppressors or cruel people. They were innocent and they were ravaged. Does that count?
Are South Vietnamese in the film. And the South Vietnamese children whose arms are supposedly hacked off by the North Vietnamese are also portrayed as victims. So you're right, there are these only two portrayals of the Vietnamese. Either they are these passive victims or else they are these savage terrorists. And there's no place in that film where you could possibly get the idea that maybe some Vietnamese wanted the Americans out. Maybe the Americans were the aggressors and the Vietnamese were intelligently and rationally going about organizing a movement and an army to defeat the Americans, not to attack other Vietnamese. See, that's what's so incredible about that story. He portrays the North Vietnamese as attacking the South Vietnamese children and really leaving out the fact that it wasn't a war, and I think history has proved this. It wasn't a war between the North Vietnamese and the Americans to over who was going to be the brutal conquerors of the South Vietnamese, so much as it really was an all Vietnam movement.
One of the problems that you get into when you're talking about the politics of a movie like Apocalypse Now is that Coppola could easily say, look, I didn't mean it to be a political statement. It's not a historical document of the war. It's not meant to be a political analysis of the war. It's a metaphor.
Yeah.
It's closer to the Heart of Darkness than it is to American politics in the late 60s and early 70s, and that he was using that as a vehicle, really, as a symbol to talk about other things, to not talk about the war.
Yeah, and that's precisely what he has done in a very vague way. And a lot of people say that. I think it's important to stop and talk about it, because we are living in the period now when the history of the war in Vietnam is being written through the culture. And for most people, this is how the war will be represented. It'll be through movies, and it'll be through fiction. That's just the way it is. So it seems to me that even a movie which fictionalizes events is offering a historical interpretation. It has in it a politics, a view about the rights and the wrongs, a view about what human brutality is and what war is. And it's that interpretation that I challenge. What John Milius, because John Milius is the screenwriter, did in making up this particular scene was he took his own fantasy, the figment of his own imagination, of something that he thought he kind of could imagine happening in Vietnam. And then he used that to back up his point of view, his interpretation, and his own politics. And that's what the movie it carries. And he imagines the North Vietnamese are the kind of people who would hack off the arms of children, even though there's no historical basis for this, no evidence at all. That's his fantasy. And so he uses it to support an overall philosophical statement, which is, in his own words, that man is descended from the apes. And he just doesn't really see any distinctions. He won't make any moral judgments about which side was which in Vietnam. By the way, I've been in a kind of correspondence with John Milius about all this.
What does he have to say?
Well, I criticized the fact that there was no factual basis for this story in my review. And because none had been supplied, and I could find absolutely no basis for it, or no references to it in any kind of news reporting or anything else. So he wrote back and said that, well, it was true because a friend of his had been a witness. So I wrote back to him and said, well, that's very interesting. I would very much like to know the man's name and address. And I'd like to ask him a lot of questions, like what the date was and why he didn't report it and whether there were any other witnesses and, how come it didn't get into the historical record and so on. So could I have his name and address and I'll interview him? And John Milius wrote me back a little poem that I can recite by heart. He wrote, "We must burn them, we must incinerate them. Pen after pen, pencil after pencil, press after press, no dialogue with communist criminals."
What does that mean?
Well, it the press after press, pen after pen, all that was a reference to Mother Jones magazine. And communist criminals I could only take to mean me. So in other words, his response to me as an investigative journalist in saying that I'd like to know the facts, and that if he claims that this was a true story and there was a witness, that, in order to back that up, I'd like to know the name and address. His response is to label me as a communist and a criminal.
Maybe he was kidding.
Well, I hope so.
So,
whether he was kidding or not, the point is that he refused to give any information.
Well, in a way, I can understand that. If it was a friend of mine, I don't know that I'd call up a journalist and say, yeah, this is his name, and you go visit him, he lives over here.
Oh, wait a minute. Let's think about that. If you're going to take a story like that and put it in a multi-billion dollar movie as a fact, you have to be able to stand up for it. I have no patience with that, because at Mother Jones, we cannot use anything that isn't fact-checked. I can't tell you how many incredible stories and unbelievable incidents that should have seen print haven't and never will, because the source won't allow his or her name to be used. So that even though you know something to be true, if you can't back it up and you can't print it. Well, I feel the same way about John Milius. I think that anybody in the special forces who witnessed something like that had an obligation to report it to his superiors, an obligation to bring it to the attention of the media and so on. And if he didn't do that, well, why should we believe? Why should we believe that it happened? Why should I believe something secondhand from John Milius claims a friend of his said that this is true? That means absolutely nothing to me.
It all comes back to, again, the idea of what responsibility a fiction writer has in dealing with things based on what really happened. It can really be said that someone who's writing fiction should have complete liberty to create whatever instances
yeah.
they please.
Well, if John Milius had said, I made this up, then you couldn't challenge him any further on that.
Right.
Then you could say, well, you made it up. Well, it's not accurate. It's not, it's, you know, you shouldn't have made it up because it's not very close to anything that was true. At least then we'd both be talking about the realm of fantasy. But, and he won't even say that.
I'm interested by what you said before about how our final remembrances of the war are going to be more based on the movies than on the war itself. I'm reminded of all the World War II movies I watched when I was a kid. Now, of course, I didn't live through the war, but I also never really read much history of World War II, but I did see a lot of war movies. So by the time I was 10, I was pretty certain I had a very strong image of what it must have been like to live through the war, or to fight the war for that matter, because there were always movies of combat. So you think that's going to be the case with Vietnam, that people are going to, say, grow up seeing The Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now and not ask themselves what's metaphor, what's symbolism, what's fiction?
Well, I think you'd be completely mystified if you saw Apocalypse Now. You would never understand how the war could have turned out the way it did. I mean, here you had this tiny little nation of the Vietnamese, poor and underdeveloped, and they didn't even have paved roads. And you had the strongest nation in the world dumping all this napalm and bombs on them and so on, and yet we lost. And that's one thing that really can't be disguised. I mean, the U.S. lost the war. Now, then you see a movie like Apocalypse Now, it's not going to help anybody understand why we lost or how we could have lost. And if there's a reason why none of these movies are helping us to understand why we lost, and that's because you can't understand why we lost without understanding that it was basically a good thing that we lost. It would have been a better thing if we'd never been over there. And I say that with a lot of pain because I think it's a hard thing to face. It was a good thing we lost that war, and it means that a lot of lives were lost unnecessarily. And as Ron Kovic and George Chenoweth and a lot of other Vietnam veterans who went over there and were either imprisoned, as Chenoweth was, or blown up, as Kovic was, you know, we'll talk about this and say that it's a terrible, tragic realization to have fought on the wrong side of a war. And yet Americans can't evade that.
It's such a difficult question to me. What do you do when someone writes a book or makes a movie that has to do with a political sequence and says that they don't mean it to be political, they mean it to be fiction and metaphorical, but built into it anyways, you see a political analysis? It's so difficult to contend with that because the filmmaker or the novelist may be right. They may have had no political intentions at all, and after all, what responsibility does the fiction writer have in all of this? It seems like a really difficult question to me.
Well, I don't know, because I think that fiction, why do we read fiction? Why do we do that anyway? Some people do it just for escape. But great fiction is read because it does help us to illuminate life itself. It helps us to understand the truth about human nature, about ourselves, about our motivations. It isn't just a fantasy land. It has a relationship. And so that, just to get back to the question of horror then, I would say that even if you wanted to judge Apocalypse Now strictly on its fictional merits, and if you compared it to Heart of Darkness, it's a real failure as a work of art. And it is a failure partly for a political reason, because it lies about the nature of horror, which Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad did not do, or at least my interpretation of it is that it did not. Apocalypse Now takes the notion of horror and really trivializes it, and pushes it away, finally, in favor of a much safer, more macho kind of power trip.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, just on artistic grounds alone, I think that is a real failure. But you can't divide art from politics, because the way that our culture understands something like that, the way that we understand masculinity, for example, or femininity, or the way that we understand who we are as a nation, or how we feel about what our country does, those things then will affect our politics in the future. So these things are all bound up together.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Deirdre English. She's a contributing editor to Mother Jones magazine, and she addressed this question in the magazine. She's also an author of a couple of books, which she co-authored with Barbara Ehrenreich. The recent book is called For Her Own Good, 150 Years of the Expert's Advice to Women. Deirdre, let's talk about another aspect of movies, one that's very controversial, which you're going to be writing on soon, and that's pornography. Now, there is a group of women based, I guess, in New York, but probably having roots around the country, who would really like to close down theaters that are showing pornography which has brutal sexual scenes in it, movies where sexuality and brutality or violence against women go hand in hand. Where do you stand on the question of how to deal with movies that have violence directed against women in pornography?
Well, we're doing a special issue on this subject at Mother Jones.
A whole issue.
And we're going to be dealing with it from a lot of different points of view. There'll be an article by the feminist author Andrea Dworkin, and she's written something about the Marquis de Sade, his life and thought, and also about the way in which he was really accepted by the intellectuals right up until the present as an important thinker. So she really kind of attacks the literate establishment for their failure to criticize de Sade. So that's one piece. I think one of the most interesting pieces in the article is going to be, because this is the issue is on pornography and violence. So this is not about pornography, but about violence. An article by Amanda Spake, who's another editor at Mother Jones, and she's doing something that I've never seen anything like this. It's a psychological profile of a rapist and an attempted murderer, and of his victim. It's the Larry Singleton case. Larry Singleton was you might have read about this. It's a horrible story that he picked up a 14-year-old hitchhiker and raped her and cut off her arms and abandoned her for dead in a ditch by the side of the road. And this girl had obviously an incredible will to live, and she managed to pull herself up and run out to the street and flag down a car and get saved. And she wound up testifying against him in court, and he went to prison. And Amanda Spake is now doing an article which is based on this case. And I think it's an extremely important thing to do. You know, we've had so many books have been written about the Nazi mentality, for example, and even about the racist mentality. But not much has really been written yet that we women can read that even helps us to understand how or compare case studies, how the mind of such a man works. So I think it's an important step forward to do that. The problem of male violence is a really extreme one, and I think it's good that the women's movement is zeroing in on it. And there's a lot that we have to do in this area of wife abuse and battering and rape and violence.
How should we deal with that, again, in fiction? How should we deal with that when it shows up in a sequence with actors on a screen where, say, a man is brutalizing a woman during a scene of having sex with her, knowing that it's a movie and that, assuming that they're real actors and that it's not like a snuff movie where the violence mm-hmm. is really being committed.
Yeah. Well, now we come to the other area, which is the area of pornography and the problem of censorship. I'm against censorship. And I'm going to be writing a piece that takes that point of view. I think it's very much possible to be a feminist who's against violence against women, and even against violence and pornography without wanting to see it censored. And I'm completely opposed to censorship. Just absolutely.
Do you think that if the women who wanted to censor these kinds of movies where there's a lot of violent pornography, that it would set really bad precedents that would end up backfiring?
Absolutely. Well, I don't think there's any question. First of all, I think that what censorship would do would be to drive the pornography industry, which is already operates in the billions of dollars, be to drive it underground. It's already a mafia-controlled industry. So it would be like narcotics. It would not be eliminated. It would some people would go to jail. There'd be some jail sentences served by some pornographers, and maybe, you know, feminists would get some satisfaction from that, but it would not prevent the movies from being made, the books from being written, and if anything, it would increase the profits, because once you go underground, then you're really justified charging, you know, the limit. So that I just don't see as a solution at all, and in fact, it would make pornography more attractive to be illegal. That's one thing. But then the other thing is that it would, once you have laws that limit the portrayal of sexual activities, that can be used against all kinds of things that we wouldn't want to see censored. It could be used against Judy Chicago, the feminist artist who does a lot of her art is very vaginal, and it's she does these dinner party are really vaginal plates. It could be used against, well, it already has occasionally when there have been local censorship laws. Feminist books like Our Bodies Ourselves have gone on the list of the censored erotic material and so on. Things pertaining to homosexuality and lesbianism, again, could be, you know, scooped right into the wastebasket.
Well, there's been two kinds of pressures, I think, that women are exerting on this matter. One is a legal pressure to try to legally outlaw brutal pornographic movies. But the other kind of pressure is just on local distributors and local movie house owners, maybe picketing in front of the movie houses
mm-hmm.
and suggesting to the person who owns the screening room that they shouldn't show violent pornography and that they shouldn't have any kind of billboards or photographs outside the movie theater that show, you know, women in bondage in sexual situations. What do you think of that approach, that second approach?
Well, I think that obviously I believe that people should be free to do that. I mean, that's a protected right, the right to demonstrate and so on. It'll be interesting to see what the effects of doing that are. It's In a way, it's hard to believe that kind of action will have much effect on pornographers themselves. And I don't think that movies are going to close down because they have some feminist picket lines in front of them for a while. So I don't have much belief in ineffectual actions, if you understand what I'm saying. And I think it's good to do them, and if it's good as a consciousness-raising thing, or if some women wanted to do that, good. But I certainly prefer to look for strategies that I think really can reach their ends. And this one doesn't seem to me to be like that.
Have you thought at all about why it exists so much, why there is so much pornography with violence in it, and that the violence is an important part of the sexuality?
Yeah, well, that's I think a subject that's on a lot of our minds these days. It's very terrifying to women to see that this is the content of so much male sexual fantasy. And we need to have so much more information about it, because we have very little idea, and when I say we, I mean, you know, the society in general, just understands very little about the relationship between fantasy and action. Fantasy has a kind of permission-giving effect, apparently, but, you know, it could, for at least for a lot of people, it could take a whole lot of very extreme fantasies to amount to a very tiny behavioral change. And all psychotherapists know this. A client in a therapy session might have violent fantasies about killing a husband or wife or father or mother or child or anything like that, and actually be the kind of person who can't even say no to a phone call from that same person, the person that they fantasize killing. So there isn't a direct relationship between fantasies and actions, and for some people, in fact, the fantasies might get more and more extreme precisely because the actions are so, the ability to act is so repressed, if you understand what I'm saying about this. Mm-hmm. And it's important to remember that about the relationship between fantasy and action. It's not direct, and I don't think it's the same for everybody.
So the implication there is that you would think that a lot of people who attended these kinds of movies wouldn't necessarily be the people who would commit violent rapes, because
well,
that might deal more with fantasy than with action.
Yeah, but then again, there for some people it may have a kind of a trigger effect, and it may be a permission-giving effect, and we need to understand a whole lot more about when that is the case and for what kind of people under what circumstances.
So you really feel ill-equipped now to really have any
analysis? Oh, the information isn't in on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any, like, personal feelings about how the two have gotten linked in so many minds?
Well, in my personal feelings are that I do not like to attack people at the level of their fantasies. I'm interested in criticizing people at the level of their actions. And what I think the problem in the society is male violence. It is when men actually rape, when they actually murder, when they actually attack us in the streets. And so I would like to, that's where I would like to orient our strategies. And by the way, I think the Take Back the Night kinds of marches are very important in that way. There was a march in New York some time ago in which women just got together in a huge number to walk through Central Park in the early evening after dark. I thought that was an important and positive kind of strength-giving kind of act.
There was one in Philadelphia, too, recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that women really saying, you know, now the streets are ours, too, and we ought to have the right to use the parks. You know, why should we live in a state of terror? So I would prefer to see the women's movement continue to operate against actual practices that we want stopped, and doing things about them, setting up shelters for wives, setting up rape crisis things, finding ways that we can get men who are against rape to cooperate with us in the anti-rape movement. I think that's an important thing. I think that that rape is a community problem, not just a women's problem, and that men who are not rapists have a responsibility to join with us as women to prevent rapes by patrolling neighborhoods or by walking women, escorting women in dark streets or whatever is necessary. Those are the kinds of things that I think can really be effectual. And I think that, you know, prying into people's secret fantasies is really, you know, when they haven't even done anything to a specific woman, is just a terrible and moralistic kind of strategy that will be ineffectual anyway, and that I'm just opposed to on moral grounds.
Okay, well, Deirdre, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about the 1970s and your feelings about what strides and setbacks have been made, particularly in the women's movement in the 1970s. It was really first getting off the ground, wasn't it, around 1970? The Feminism, modern feminism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so funny, you know, so many people will talk about the 1970s as if it was a period of quiescence and nothing happened and, you know, the 60s were dead. Everybody said all through the 70s as if it, you know, meant that there was no great political progress. And it's so untrue. The 1970s was the decade of feminism. And feminism spread from being a kind of tiny radical fringe to really being a mass movement, absolutely you know, not a class-bound movement, but one which has tremendous numbers of adherents among working-class women, something which has made enormous strides and which is a popular progressive movement.
In the early 70s, consciousness-raising groups were first sprouting in some areas around the country. And by the late 70s, I think they almost died out because everybody had been through them already. Maybe that's not quite true, but what are some of the most dramatic changes that you see over the 70s?
Well, I think that the winning of new reproductive rights has been one of the most important. The right to abortion, which we're still defending and which is facing setbacks, is obviously... It's absolutely indispensable to liberation for women in the circumstances that women find themselves in the modern world. The ERA is important, and I just sure hope it passes. It'll be a big setback if it's not passed. But at least the recognition throughout this country that women are discriminated against and that women, the widespread agreement today that women should be at least paid equally with men and should have equal access to jobs and education and so on. That's just a huge step forward in consciousness.
There have been some interesting changes in approaches to childbirth.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that goes along with the whole consciousness of body issues for women. I think women, you know, in the 1970s, it was very clear that body issues, contraception, abortion, different relationship with the medical association, doctors in the hospital system in general. All these things have been important parts of feminism because our bodies are keys to liberation for women in a way that isn't true for men. And we have to have control over our reproductivity as women.
Do you think it's fair to look at how women's fashions changed over the 70s? And
sure, see if you can, I think it's fascinating.
about what that says? What do you think was fashionable in the early 70s? It's hard to say, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think that obviously there was there's been a decade-long reaction against the miniskirt of the late 60s. And in a way, it was as though women really, after the miniskirt, said, all right, that did it, you know? No, you know, we've gone, you know, enough is enough. And, you know, women really, I think somehow this is just a speculation on my part, but I do kind of have the feeling that, you know, women felt that we really kind of had participated in some sort of, you know, mass delusion or something, wandering around in those miniskirts, which were just far more trouble than they were worth, and got us into more trouble than was worth. And so, obviously, through the 70s, fashion has reflected that.
Well, skirts seem to nearly go out of style altogether around the early 70s and seem to be back in style again now that it's the late 70s. Do you think that that has any social implications to it?
Well, yeah. You mean, well, the skirts being back?
Yeah.
Well, I think you might be talking about the whole return to femininity, the new, what some people are calling the new romanticism. It's skirts doesn't bother me, but, you know, the real return of pointy high heels and, I don't know, lots of makeup and more of the kind of what's called retro chic, stuff that's reminiscent of the 1950s and of the kind of femininity that's really, you know, really labored over. That kind of bothers me because I think that it reflects a real insecurity that women have about whether or not we can afford to to take the steps that we're taking towards liberation and towards equality with men.
Mm-hmm.
And some very deep fears that the consequences of equality are too painful.
In the early 70s, there were so few women in positions of authority or power. It was a lot of fun to sit and fantasize what it would be like if women ran this or if women ruled that. And I think a lot of people had really idealized fantasies that, you know, if women ran the government, there wouldn't be wars. If women ran the government, there'd be a lot less poverty. Now there's more women in positions of authority than there were before. And do you think it's become any more difficult to fantasize ideal situations if women were in power?
Well, I guess so. I mean, I actually think, though, that historically we're still in a transitional period, and it will be a very long time before men and women have equal access to power, and that if women are in powerful positions, that I certainly don't think they can do worse than men have done. And I actually still have optimism that they'll do better.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, that's a hope, not a, you know, proven belief or anything like that. But the fact that we have some Margaret Thatchers and so on in the world now who've shown that they can be just as much against working people and poor people, they can be just as conservative and as men have been, that shouldn't surprise us, because wouldn't the first women who get into power, you know, at least often tend to be the women who are most favored by men, at least in this period?
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I still do have some. I actually do think that there's some. There is a connection between women's biological role as birth giver and a different feeling that women have about human life. So I still hold out some hope that having women in positions of power will have a peace-bringing effect in the world.
Do you think it's fair to look at popular culture for a minute and see how women have been pictured in it over the past decade? I think of television serials, for instance. There's single women and working women on television serials now.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. I don't think I had a TV in 1970, so it's maybe not fair for me to be looking back. But it seems to me, as someone who doesn't watch a lot of TV, that there are more independent women who are in the regular serials and sitcoms now.
Mm-hmm.
Seem that way to you?
Yeah, it does. I think that it can be a mistake to attribute that to feminism, though. It's not feminism which brought women into the labor force. And it seems like a simple point, but it's one which is worth repeating, that women were a real historical turning point for women came with the end of World War II. Before World War II, the typical woman worker in this country was a single woman without children who really was working until she got married, when she would drop out of the labor force. After World War II, the typical working woman had become an older married woman with children, and that's remained the pattern ever since, and that population of women workers has been consistently growing, so that now any young woman getting her education in high school or college really knows that unless she's an exception, or happens to marry an exceptionally rich man or something like that, and even so today she can't be sure that's going to last, but that she expects to have a full-time career for the rest of her life, with maybe a couple of years taken out for childbearing at best. So whether you're a feminist or not, as a woman, that is the future that you face today. We don't face being homemakers and staying home and making frilly pink curtains. It isn't an option. And feminism is a response to that. Feminism didn't bring that about. Feminism really is not a movement which said, let's get women out of the home and into the workforce. It's misportrayed that way quite a lot. But feminism really deals with the question, since we have to be in the labor force, are we going to continue to be in it only at the very bottom, at the lowest wages and in the least interesting jobs, or are we going to go into it on our own terms, as equals?
That's interesting. Getting back to how popular culture portrays women, it seems that advertisers have really been picking up, though, on the sense of feminism and are trying to sell everything from Tampax to detergents, not necessarily, but frequently, with a pitch that, oh, you don't have any time to do this, that, and the other thing anymore because you're a busy, modern, independent woman, so try our product because it does the job twice as fast or twice as good or whatever, whatever. I'm sure you've noticed that. How do you feel about the selling, the marketing of products addressing itself?
Yeah, well, I just think that advertisers are just always very smart at figuring out how to exploit, you know, the changes in our lives for their own profit, and that that's what that is. And I don't, you know, I don't think it adds to feminism in any way, or, you know, I don't particularly appreciate those images of working women.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any changes around you, like in the neighborhood that you live in and in your friends' lives and neighbors' lives in over the 70s, you know, that are caused by feminism?
Oh, they've just been enormous. Just enormous. I mean, well, one of the major changes has been the fact that so many young women haven't had children because they have gone into the workforce. And again, as I said, whether they're feminists or not, they've had jobs. And whether they're feminists or not, they have having a job alone requires a different kind of relationship with men. I think feminism will help you to understand that, and if a man is a feminist too, you know, you kind of have something going for you. You'll be able to strategize and understand what's happening a little better. But in either case, and women have new needs from relationships with men, and what I've seen is, to a very great extent, is that those needs not being met, and so a lot has been sacrificed, and the family, in part, has been sacrificed, and child raising has been sacrificed, because women can't do it alone. And if they're not going to have a different kind of cooperation from men, and if they're not going to find men who really are interested in pioneering new kinds of relationships with new responsibilities, then women won't be able to do it at all.
Do you have any predictions about the 1980s, if you've been thinking about what might happen in the next decade?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we really are facing a hard, hard decade as feminists, because it's the financial picture looks very bad, and this has a real chilling effect on women's ability to get the kind of equalization in wages that we need. It's going to slow us down. And what's very serious also is the fact that women are ununionized on the whole. Areas of the economy that employ the largest numbers of women are clerical work and sales work, are two major examples, are the most ununionized sectors of the economy, largely because they do employ women and nobody has ever bothered to unionize women. The big male unions just haven't cared about women workers. And feminists haven't gotten it together in this area either. I think we're going to find in the 1980s that feminism cannot make the kinds of gains in bringing about equality without some kind of a union strategy, without creating female unions. They don't have to be all women unions by any means. But I think we're going to have a women's union movement in some form. Otherwise, working class women are going to be just continually driven down below the poverty line, and most working women will, especially in an age of more and more divorce, will find it completely impossible to hold their families together.
So you see the need for these unions for job security and higher wages?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you think that movement has already started?
Not nearly enough so. No, I'm really saying that I think this is practically at crisis proportions for the women's movement. The faster we recognize it and get started, the better. I mean, there are women who are doing this. I mean, there are organizations of clerical workers and so on. There's 9-to-5 and there's women office workers, and there are groups in many of the major cities, but I think that they've barely begun to take off in terms of what's needed.
Well, Deirdre, I wish you the best in the next decade. We're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being here this afternoon. I really wish we had some more time to talk.
Thank you.
Maybe you could come back sometime. Maybe you'll be in Philadelphia again.
Great. Well, my parents live here, so...
Oh, great. Good. Maybe we'll see you again.
Good.
I've been talking to Deirdre English. She's now a contributing editor to the radical magazine Mother Jones, and as she mentioned in an issue in the near future, there's going to be a whole issue devoted to the question of violence and pornography. She's also the author of two books with Barbara Ehrenreich. One is called Witches, Midwives, and Nurses, and the other is called For Her Own Good, 150 Years of the Expert's Advice to Women. And that's published in paper now by Anchor Doubleday. And it's a look at how doctors have historically analyzed women's problems, health problems, sometimes according to the doctor's view of what women's emotional makeup was, and how stereotypes about women's nature affected medical diagnosis of women's health problems. Deirdre, thanks again for being here.
Thank you, Terry.
This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 3:30. Every Friday at about this time, Bill Van Wert joins us to talk about movies. In just a couple of minutes, Bill Van Wert is going to discuss genre films. This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Every Friday at about 3:30 on Fresh Air, we're joined by Bill Van Wert, who talks about movies, reviews new movies, talks about movies on television. This week, Bill's going to be talking about genre movies and what's happened recently to movies in various genres. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I should probably define genre for people who don't know what it is. It's spelled G-E-N-R-E. It's French, and it means kind or category. What happened is that after World War II, some young French critics who became filmmakers, Jean-Luc Godard, François Truffaut, Eric Rohmer, Jacques Rivette, and a few others, decided that one could study film, a body of films, in terms of their kind. And they broke them down into westerns, horror films, gangster films, science fiction. We know those categories now. We accept them now as a foregone conclusion. They weren't such at the time. I know when I was growing up, what I had was like the Legion of Decency Code or ABC films or whatever. And Westerns, for example, were never worthy of study, certainly not in any kind of academic sense. And now they are classified. I think what I'd like to do first is to talk about what made a classic Western or gangster film or science fiction film or horror film, and then sum up at the end with what's happened to them as I see it. I'd like to pair up the Western with the gangster film for several reasons. The Western treats primarily